The Five-Dimensional Man by Kate Orman.
Her name is Mrs. Mark Brown, or if you prefer, just plain Betty. She's 25 years old. Her occupation, American housewife. No children yet. Perhaps that's why she's just such a soft touch for strays. So far, she's talked Mr. Brown into letting her keep 2 dogs, 3 cats, and a lost parrot. The clock on the kitchen wall strikes 3 as Betty mentally rehearses her evening. Make the jello salad, get the meatloaf into the oven, dust the living room, freshen herself up. She'll be ready to start mixing the martinis as usual when she hears Mark's wheels in the driveway. That gives her a whole hour to write first. Betty stares at the obstinately blank page, smelling typewriter oil and floor wax. Try as she might today, nothing comes into her head. Even glancing over the garish covers of her favorite magazines with names like Amazing and Astounding isn't providing any inspiration. Although one day Betty's pen name is going to appear on one of these covers above the rocket ships and bug-eyed monsters. Right now, there's nothing either amazing or astounding about her life. But that's about to change. Because in a moment, the small dimensions of Betty Brown's everyday world will be opened up just for a moment by a visitor from a 5th dimension.
It was Debussy hissing at nothing that made her look up. The kitten spat and arched its back. Betty gasped. There was someone else in the kitchen. Or was there? It was a dark-haired girl in a yellow and black one-piece garment. Betty could see the stove through her. For a moment, she thought her stubborn imagination had cooked it up. But in a moment, the girl became as solid and real as anything else in the kitchen. In one hand, she held the helmet of her spacesuit. In the other, a strange, glittering thing that looked like a set of colored plastic pipes that had melted together. The girl opened her mouth, as though to speak. But then her eyes glazed and her head fell back. Betty leapt out of her chair and was in time to catch the girl as she fainted. The helmet bounced and rolled, chasing Debussy across the linoleum. But the girl held on to the sparkling object as though her life depended on it. The girl sat up with a start.
The Trotanic crystal!
She looked around, frantic, dark hair swinging, startled as the puppy yapped at her and Pierrot squawked and flapped his wings.
Please, said Betty. Everyone calm down.
She pushed what she took to be the crystal gingerly across the coffee table.
It's right here, and here's a glass of water.
The girl stared.
Don't worry, I don't bite.
She pressed her palm against the puppy's head, soothing him.
Neither does Offenbach. I'm sorry, you must think me awfully strange. My name's Zoe. Please call me Betty. Are you an astronaut? It's just that you look like you should be in high school, not doing whatever it is you're doing.
The girl took a deep breath and said,
What year is this? It's 1959, October the 2nd. You don't seem very surprised that I asked.
Zoe smiled, patting Offenbach, who wagged his tail and grinned.
Shouldn't you be worried I might be a hallucination or something?
Betty shook her head firmly.
I don't believe that somebody can hallucinate things they haven't already imagined. I've conjured up a lot of things sitting at my typewriter. People and places you wouldn't... But you probably would believe it, wouldn't you? What I mean to say is that I've never imagined anyone like you.
There were so many questions, she barely knew where to start.
Are you from the future? Are there many women astronauts in the future? Well, of course, but this isn't my spacesuit. I sort of borrowed it.
Zoe held up the Trotanic crystal.
The doctor told me this is the key to Stirling's plan, so I borrowed that too.
Betty had a sudden sinking feeling.
Your doctor? No, the doctor.
She saw Betty's frown.
Look, there's this man. Lord Ferdinand Stirling. He's a scientist from the 28th century. He lives on an artificial satellite called Planet 801. He's reprogrammed all the maintenance robots and taken it over, and now he's trying to start a war with the Earth. If he does that, the Trotanic fallout could cause all sorts of terrible mutations. So we have to stop him.
Betty leaned forward.
We? Can I help? Do you need to get back to Planet 801?
Well, that's just it.
I can't, said Zoe, drooping.
I'm terribly lucky that I ended up here. Sterling's time travel booth could have sent me anywhere. The doctor's got a space-time machine of his own, but he can't really steer it.
Betty found her mind accepting everything the girl said, turning it over as though it was a conundrum for the characters in one of her stories.
How could we let your friend know where you are? She mused. You haven't got some sort of device for communicating through time, or know how to make one?
Zoe shook her head.
Well then, if we left some sort of message, with latitude and longitude and the date, carved in stone or something like that, so it'd last for centuries.
But it wouldn't make any difference, said Zoe.
Even if we could let the doctor know where I am, he wouldn't be able to make the TARDIS land here.
Zoe, said Betty,
who is the doctor?
Well, I don't know exactly.
Zoe's young face took on a distant look.
He's very old, I think, and very clever and very kind. He can travel absolutely anywhere in the five dimensions.
Is that where he comes from?
Said Betty.
A fifth dimension.
Zoe's eyes widened, staring behind Betty, who felt the little hairs on the back of her neck stand up. A moment later, her permanent wave was starting to stir as though there was a draft coming from somewhere. She turned to where Zoe was looking. The curtains flew. The air screamed and split open. Betty clapped her hands to her ears, staring at the shape appearing beside the television. Pyrrho shrieked,
Shiver me timbers!
It's the TARDIS!
Cried Zoe delightedly.
The doctor's found me after all!
The time machine was a solid, squared-off ultramarine capsule, almost as tall as the living room ceiling. A man stepped out and broke into a pleased smile.
Zoe!
The girl jumped up.
Oh, Doctor, I didn't know if you'd be able to find me. Luckily, the TARDIS was able to home in on the crystal.
This was Zoe's five-dimensional man? Not an egg-headed genius in a surgeon's white gown, not a square-jawed Superman with a flying helmet and goggles, but a little fellow in an unironed suit.
Where's Jamie?
Zoe was saying worriedly.
I'm afraid Professor Stirling has taken him hostage. He wants the Trotanic crystal in exchange for Jamie. What are we going to do? We're going to give it to him, of course.
The doctor seemed to notice Betty for the first time.
We can get back by reversing the journey, but we've got to hurry. You'd better say goodbye to your friend.
Betty, said Zoe.
No,
said Betty. They both stopped and looked at her.
You can't leave me behind after all this. She could be our secret weapon,
said Zoe quickly.
The robots haven't had a chance to scan her yet, so she's not in their memory store. They should look right through her, as though she isn't even there. Now, Betty,
said the shabby little man, fixing her with his grey gaze.
You're asking us to put you in mortal danger. Stirling is a cold-blooded murderer. Now, I hope you'll forgive me for saying this, but you don't look as though you belong in a war zone. I'm pretty harmless,
she admitted.
I can't even kill spiders in the bathtub. I mean, I try to put them outside before Mark gets home.
She laughed.
But look at you, Doctor. You're not exactly General MacArthur, are you?
She met his eyes.
Let me help you save your friend, please. Please, I've just got to see. Oh, can't we take her with us, Doctor? Oh, very well,
he said gruffly.
Betty, I'm going to give you one thing to do. It shouldn't take you more than a few moments. You can have a very quick look at the future, and then you must go straight back to the TARDIS where you'll be safe.
Betty's heart leapt. She couldn't say a word. She only beamed.
Come along, then.
When Betty Brown steps out of the door of the Doctor's time machine, the first thing she sees is that she's in outer space. Ahead of her, there is a vast window that looks out on the blackness spattered with the blazing stars of a cold, clear night. It takes her several seconds to tear her eyes away from the view, to look at the room she's standing in. A large, dimly lit scientific laboratory, full of equipment that looks like the mysterious sculptures of modern art. Blonde men in spacesuits walk about between them at unknown tasks. As Betty looks closer, she sees they're not people at all. They're robots, moving stiffly, awkwardly, expressions never changing. The doctor puts a hand on her arm and points across the room, where a tall man stands with his back to her, working at a bench. He wears a high-collared cloak that hides his face from view. Beside him stands one of the robots, its gloved hands clasped on the shoulders of a dark-haired young man, wearing a spacesuit identical to Zoe's. It has to be Jamie. When he sees his friends, he tries to pull away, but the robot holds him fast in a metal grip. Zoe waves frantically and puts a finger to her lips, and he reluctantly holds still. Then the doctor indicates a wide, flat machine which looks like the crystal she holds in her hands, only far larger. In the side is the little window into which her crystal can be slotted like a battery into a flashlight. Place it there, the doctor has explained, and Planet 801's force field will be reactivated. Sterling's Trotonic missiles won't be able to reach the Earth. Can it really be that simple? Betty's about to find out.
The doctor stepped into the room. At once, several of the robots began pacing across the floor towards him. He adjusted his bow tie and cleared his throat.
Professor Sterling, he said loudly, I brought back the Trotonic crystal just as you insisted.
The cloaked man didn't turn round. Instead, the robot holding Jamie spoke in a melodic voice.
You will bring it here at once.
But I don't have it, said the doctor. Do I, Zoe?
The girl darted into the room, away from the doctor.
I'm the one who took it,
she called out. Some of the robots turned away from the doctor to follow her. The doctor winked at Betty over his shoulder. She slipped out of the door, heart beating fast, heading for the machine. A robot stepped close to her, and she froze in place. But it walked around her as though she was a piece of furniture. The metal men took no notice of her at all, just as Zoe had said. But her high heels were clacking on the metal floor with a sound like gunshots. That must have been what attracted Sterling's attention. Just as she reached the machine and was about to slide open the little window on the side, Sterling turned from his workbench with a strange clicking noise, and Betty stared, frozen to the spot. Half of the man's face was taken up by a glittering, faceted eye. Where his body wasn't hidden by the cape, it was covered in dark, smooth plates. And instead of a left arm, he had dozens of narrow legs waving in a sickening rhythm.
Oh, you poor man, she breathed. What have you done to yourself?
From across the room, Zoe cried,
Sterling, you used the Trotonic radiation on yourself.
Sterling's deep, rich voice was punctuated by mandible clicks.
The strength of the millipede fused with a human intellect. You were so certain I couldn't do it, Doctor.
Well, you haven't done it, have you?
He shouted, dodging robots.
You've just made a bit of a mess of yourself.
Betty took a step towards Sterling.
Stay back,
called Jamie, wriggling in the grip of his robot guard.
Proof of concept,
said Sterling lightly, ignoring everyone except the Doctor.
All I have to do now is perfect the process.
Then that's why you want to start a war, said Zoe. You'll turn the whole Earth and everyone on it into an experiment.
Aye, that's what he plans,
shouted Jamie.
Choose the best of the survivors, he said, and breed them together like...
A robot hand clamped over his mouth, leaving him scowling and silent. Sterling said,
In the end, my children will swarm over the Earth.
He leered at Zoe and Betty.
Our children, the new, improved human race.
Betty hadn't heard a word of it. All she was aware of was the angry scarring where human and inhuman flesh joined, where chitin abraded skin. All she could see was the lost eye, the missing arm. She took another step towards him.
Does it hurt? She said.
Sterling twisted suddenly, rearing up above her, half face contorted with rage, screaming thinly.
Why don't you fear me, you soft fool?
Betty hardly noticed Zoe snatched the Trotonic crystal out of her grasp.
She reached out and pressed her palm against the hard shell of Sterling's mutated shoulder. He looked down at her hand, bewildered.
Stop!
Screamed Sterling. For a moment, Betty thought he meant her, but he was pointing his human hand at Zoe as she slotted the crystal into the machine. The robot let go of Jamie, limping quickly towards Zoe, gloved hands outstretched. Jamie sprang at Sterling, grabbing two of his flailing millipede legs. Sterling roared and spun back and forth, knocking Betty aside. The scientist struck at Jamie, but the young man held fast, half dragging, half shoving him across the floor of the laboratory.
Leave her,
Sterling ordered his robot.
Help me.
But it was too late. In the confusion, Zoe slammed the crystal into its place in the force field generator. It sprang to life with a whining hum. At the same moment, Jamie wrestled Sterling towards a glassy box the size of a phone booth, full of writhing, sparkling energy.
In you go, you insect devil!
Cried Jamie, placing his boots squarely in Sterling's back. The half-man, half-monster plummeted into the thrumming maw of his self-made time-travel booth. As he vanished into unknown time and space, he howled,
You ignorant fool!
Millipedes aren't insects!
The clock on the kitchen wall strikes four. There's still time for Mrs. Brown to have dinner ready when Mark gets home, as long as she gets started right away. Debussy winds around her ankles as she zips her typewriter up in its case, and in the living room, Pierrot starts squawking about pieces of eight. She tidies away the colourful magazines onto their shelf, finding herself glancing through the covers again at the robots and the monsters and the mad scientists. She drops them suddenly.
What's the matter with me?
She gasps. She runs to the living room. Beside the TV, in the carpet, there's a deep, deep square of crushed shag pile where something heavy stood only minutes ago. Betty hugs herself and beams, heart swelling. Looking around at the rest of the room, she sees that the puppy has shed hairs on the sofa and the mantelpiece needs dusting. Glancing in the mirror, she notices that her face and her hair need to be fixed too. She listens to the hollow ticking of the clock, takes a deep breath and says, No time like the present. In the kitchen, Betty takes her typewriter out again. Offenbach curls at her feet as she sits down at the table. After a moment, she slips in a fresh sheet of paper and begins to type.